Session number 3971, reel number 4.
Mr. O'Neill, Reel 4. You joined the PR outfit in Curzon Street in around August 1944. How did you feel about leaving the Army Film Unit? Were you sad or were you quite relieved?
Well, I never felt that I left it because I was in communication through the pictures coming through with the photographers I knew in Northwest Europe, and there was no sense of having left the unit, particularly when I left PR at the War Office to join up with Soldier Magazine, because there again the photographers on Soldier Magazine were, I had known from the Pinewood days, and certainly when I went out to Hamburg, which was the printing centre of Soldier Magazine, there was the unit was stationed, the old AFPU 5 was stationed in Hamburg for the most part. So I met up with all the photographers again. So there's no sense of ever leaving AFP. And indeed, on the shoulder, I still wore for an awful long time the AFPU flash.
So was it true then that you were not struck off the nominal list belonging to No. 5 Army Film and Photo Section for a long time?
I don't know about that. I may have been done physically, but in heart, no.
How well did you get to know Major Horton during this period?
Got to know him very well because he worked directly opposite him at the adjoining desk, and I knew of his reputation as chief photographer of the Times and one of the great stalwarts of photography in Fleet Street, and he was a very kind and very generous man. He had one or two peculiar foibles. Whenever he used to go away with Churchill on a visit to Casablanca or one of these other places that Churchill would go to meet the other great heads of state, he would come into the office in the morning, never say a word, lock his desk, pick up his attaché case and walk out. And he would never say where he was going, but everybody knew where he was going. So I suppose any likely spy hanging around Curzon Street watching Bill Horton go through this procedure would know exactly what was happening higher up the government system.
Were you at this stage thinking in terms of a post-war career in journalism, and did Major Horton give you any sort of encouragement or any indicators as to what you might be able to do after the war?
No, he didn't, no. Though my bent vaguely was to go back to Manchester and possibly join the Express. Bear in mind that I'd had no what might call approved training. I had learned photography all myself. In fact, the only instruction I ever had was a direct nature was from in the Army Film Unit, where on the still side at least they didn't tell me if I hadn't already learned from experience as a freelance and from reading books. But I stayed with Soldier Magazine for about 3 years, as far as I remember, and we were taking feature pictures as opposed to news pictures, and this was the thing because illustrated and picture posts were still in the heyday, and I became very interested in this, developed one or two techniques I rather liked, and I was thinking more of a magazine future for myself when I got out, but I realised that it would be very hard to get on one of the two existing magazines, Illustrator or Picture Post, without some contacts there or influence. It was a very, very, very competitive world to get jobs on those magazines.
Did you reckon that the experience you'd gained, well, most of the press photographers you had been working in Manchester were sort of called up, leaving you with a clear field to get on with it? Did you think that experience was insufficient then?
Yes, because, you see, I've never been really tested. The photographer's never really tested in the commercial world. press world when he's up, until he's up against other photographers covering the same job. One can't judge one against oneself all the time. Anyhow, it was a coincidence. I had to cover a story in East Anglia for a Soldier magazine. I came back to Liverpool Street Station about 5:30 at night, got off the train, and bumped into a chap called Carter. He was a lieutenant colonel, had been a lieutenant colonel, number two to Sean Fielding at Soldier magazine. And when Sean Fielding left Soldier magazine to take over the editorship of the Tatler, Carter went with him as his deputy editor, and we exchanged hellos and reminiscences. He said, "What are you doing these days?" I told him. He said, "Well, why don't you come and do some work for us?" I said, "Well, I know absolutely nothing about the society world. It's totally new to me, and nothing at all about it." He said, "Well, don't worry," he says. We can show you which way it's done. He said, "Come and see us." So I went to see him and Sean and got the big hand from them. It was very amusing because Sean had been running the Tatler and Soldier magazine until his retirement from the army from Elvino's in Fleet Street, and he's been quite a queue of Soldier contributors and Tatler contributors, totally different types, waiting to meet him there. But anyhow, that was by the way. And he introduced me to the staff there and to the news editor, and said, "Would you like to do some of this work for us?" I said, "Yes," because working for Soldier magazine had given me a fair bit of time to myself. We weren't out all day and every day.
What sort of stories would you be covering for Soldier magazine, and what sort of audience were you? Obviously soldiers, but...
To inform the army about the army. The reason why certain regiments did certain things in certain ways. Very bright and newsy, and there was very little inference, as far as I experienced, as far as I knew, from the higher-ups. There was very little direction as to what, in those days anyhow, as to what had to be done or said. Possibly another reason why I thought of going to work for Tatler magazine, apart from the opportunity offered to me, was that a short time previously that they decided to civilianise Soldier magazine. In other words, as the chaps who were there in uniform became civilians, they were offered their old jobs back as civilians, and also we had civil servants brought in to do the office work and the typical editorial routine. And I remember the first question the senior civil servant asked me when he came. He said, "How many days leave have you had this year? I'm still in the army." I said, "Oh, so many." Oh, he said, "Well, if you become a civilian, of course you'll get so many, and you'll get allowed so many days sick leave." I said, "What's sick leave?" He said, "You're entitled to so many days a year sick leave." So the message was starting to write on the wall which way it was going to be under civil service domination. And also the education directorate started to take a hand in the running of soldiers. I remember we started doing rather more stories about army education. Anyhow,
this sort of thing didn't interest you, I take it?
No, not really, because the substance of those stories was, I thought, much inferior to the kind of story we had been doing for Soldier magazine. We went all over the place, Malta, Gibraltar, Middle East, revisiting battlefields, and quite a host of very interesting stories. In fact, Soldier magazine was just as readable to the civilian, I thought, as, say, Picture Post Illustrated, because the area covered was very, very wide, and it wasn't propaganda biased. It wasn't plugging the army all the time, as well as the good side.
You said
we actually got several scoops with Soldier magazine. Many things which had been secret during the war were now revealed to the public for the first time, and made very good reading and very good picture stories. I remember there was one in Hamburg. It was called the Klopstock Pension, which was the school where the German spies were taught to condense a page of type writing, typewritten or otherwise, into a pinhead and inserted under a full stop in a letter. And this is how messages were sent to and from America. And we actually spoke to the person who had run this at the pension in Hamburg. And on the British side, there was all kinds of secret weapons which had been used during the war. And the full description and the full details of the damage and success they'd had was revealed. It's all very interesting. Brought up a lot of human stories too. Some very amusing stories, particularly from the desert, where we found a bunch of Arabs led by a local sheikh who were making an absolute fortune from blowing up wrecked German and British tanks by the aid of out-of-date British and German mines, which are liable to go off at any moment. And they reckoned a very high casualty list, which would not be acceptable in any army. But there they were, carrying on merrily just outside Tobruk, doing this very good business, and selling the scrap metal to who would have it.
So, sort of summarise to date on your career in photography, that your main bias in photography lay with photojournalism, and that the Army Film and Photographic Unit episode in your career constituted your sole experience of cine photography. Did you give at any time any thought to the idea of going into the world of the film industry after the war, such as perhaps being a newsreel cameraman or any other such capacity at all?
No, I had no thought of going into the studios, because I saw from my life at Pinewood that this was very much a closed shop. Also, it seemed to me to be a very precarious profession, because a lot of the civilians who worked at Pinewood had, during the war, had worked, of course, say, before the war, and we talked with them and we heard their stories of how they were employed at quite a high rate of pay for 3 months of the year working on a film, and then you had to start hopping around looking for another film which might not turn up for another 9 months or so. It struck me as if it had been a very uncertain industry.
You said just now a closed world, and that's how the film world appeared to you. Could you expand on that remark?
They really did talk in terms of photography in a different language from still photographers and newspaper photographers. Most of them were studio trained. Most of the people who came across were studio trained, and this was sort of more theatre as opposed to the reality of news work.
Since the war, you worked as a freelance photographer for Harper's Queen, Vogue and Tatler. In view of this subsequent experience, what do you think the Army Film Unit taught you, or what value do you think, in fact, the experience was?
Well, the Army Film Unit, apart from giving me camera experience, admittedly it was cine, but still it was experience, during the war years, where I might have been marching up and down on guard duty somewhere, one can't really say it gave me any advantage to the life I'm leading today. On the other hand, one did keep very close touch with the newspaper and magazine industry, from the simple fact that your fellow soldiers were also in the business. And certainly in the case of Sean Fielding, which I've already mentioned, there was a very good contact for when one came out of the army. I hadn't thought of it at the time when I was on Soldier magazine, but that was a kind of camaraderie that did exist. But actually, as for if the question is training me for photography in civilian life, I would say no. No way. It was just a continuation of what I had been doing anyhow. But it was cine, of course.
Did you think that you'd been doing something useful? That you were better employed in the film unit?
Oh,
than
yes,
you would have been?
Very much so. I know my capabilities as a soldier, as an infantryman. And, I think possibly was worthwhile what I was doing. At least it showed a section of the war as I saw it to somebody.
How many of the photographers from the Army Film Unit did you keep in touch with and perhaps help each other out getting jobs after the war?
Strange enough, there was not much difficulty in getting a job after the war. They wanted me to stay on Soldier magazine as a soldier and offered me a commission, but I said no, I would leave the army but come back as a civilian. But there's no one I can think of at the moment who had difficulty after the war in getting a job, because they all returned to their old jobs.
These are the Stills boys.
The Stills boys. They returned to their old jobs, and those who'd not been in the business before, again, some of those returned to their own old jobs. I know one who went back to being an accountant, but others did manage to get an intro into the business, chiefly into the film business, and didn't seem to have too much difficulty. And then one or two of them since have made quite a success.
Was there anybody, in your opinion, who managed to get into the Army Film Unit with no photographic experience whatsoever and used that as a springboard into bigger and better things in the photographic or film industry?
Well, I think I mentioned Ken Higgins. He was a chap a little older than I was, and as far as I know, he had no photographic experience whatsoever. But he was taken to the Army Film Unit, and I think he certainly was trained by the Army Film Unit. He was a cine photographer. I lost touch with him, though he must have been demobbed shortly before I was. And I next came across him on the set of Caesar and Cleopatra at Elstree some years ago now, where he was lighting cameraman, and very big job in on the production, and he was very well thought of by the crews there. So I had a word with them, and he definitely made a name for himself.
So to that extent, the Army Film Unit experience was of definite value to some people. As a
oh yes, artist. I mean, say there was Mike Lewis, the airborne photographer. He continued with cine photography, and he's now with the BBC. Oh yes. I shouldn't think anybody regarded who was on the Army Film Unit regarded as wasted time. No way.